We're now beginning the 49th Psalm. The title of this psalm states that it is to the chief musician, a psalm for the sons of Korah. Now, we've had this phrase before, and what this means is that the chief musician was to take this psalm and to use it to the very best advantage for the music service of the church. The phrase, a psalm for the sons of Korah, means either that the sons or the descendants of Korah wrote this psalm, or that they are the ones who are to take it and to use it properly in the music service of the church. For the sons of Korah were deeply involved in the music portion of the congregation of Israel. This psalm is a sermon. It's a lesson. This one and so is the next psalm. In most of the psalms, we have the writer praying or praising, but in these two psalms, we have him teaching some of the great principles of God. And of course, it is our duty in singing psalms to teach and admonish ourselves and one another. But the scope and the design of this lesson and this 49th psalm is to convince the men of this world of their sin and folly in setting their hearts upon the things of this world, and then to try to persuade them that they should seek the things of a better world. And also, this psalm has a purpose to comfort the people of God as to their own troubles and the grief that arises from the prosperity of the wicked. This psalm teaches a very needed lesson, a lesson which if we choose to remain ignorant of, it'll cause us to misdirect our whole lives and we'll have a tremendous amount of grief by not following the principles laid down in this psalm. The writer of this psalm considers this subject to be so vital and so important that he demands the attention of others to that which he's about to say. In the first verse he says, "Hear this, all ye people. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world." Here's something that is to be heard. Here's something that some attention is to be paid to. Hear this and give ear. Hear this, all ye people. There is not anyone to whom this teaching does not apply. There's no one who is immune from the grief and the problems that'll come as a result of being ignorant of this teaching. Give ear, all ye inhabitants of the world. This would include not only those in Judea, those that are people of God, but everyone in the world should be aware of and should know this great principle that he's about to speak here. He says in verse 2, "Both low and high, rich and poor together." Now the subject is going to be the inordinate desire for riches. It's going to be the subject of having an improper sense of value as to where to place the attaining of riches and the use of riches. And we see that man has a need for this lesson. He's never really learned the fact that riches are not going to get him out of his difficulty, that riches are not the true source of security that he thinks they are, and so he places an inequitable amount of value and energy and effort upon the attaining of riches. So this is true of the low and the high. It doesn't matter what your station in life is. It doesn't matter how many riches you have or do not have. It's your feeling toward those riches. It's your attitude toward them. It's the way that you use them that really counts. So the person that's of low estate can have just as much of a chance to have an improper feeling toward riches as a person of high estate. As a matter of fact, he may even more apt to place a greater value upon riches, since he doesn't have very many riches, than the person of a high estate will. He says this also applies to the rich and poor. And truly we do know that the poor person may have his sense of values distorted in that he believes and dreams that if he could just have riches, everything would be fine. It would solve all of his problems. And so he may have his sense of value so distorted that he then places his great value upon riches, although he doesn't have them. He wants to have them. He has this great desire for them. And his life is a slave to trying to obtain riches. And of course, this applies to the rich, because they are the ones who do have the riches. They are the ones who can really say, "I'm going to have my security in this." And they many, many times do this very thing. So this applies to all stations and to all classes of persons. The low and the high, the rich and the poor, they must have a proper understanding about riches, about the obtaining of this world's goods, about the use of this world's goods, and about the affection that we place upon them. It is a lesson about our sense of values. It's a lesson about where our priorities should be. Should we be placing our emphasis upon obtaining of riches in this life, or should we be placing the emphasis upon laying up for ourselves treasures in heaven? That's what this lesson is going to be about. And so not only does he call the attention to all the inhabitants of the world to listen to what he's going to say, he says in verse 3 that he also has his own attention on this matter. He says, "My mouth shall speak of wisdom, and the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding." The things I'm going to say are wise things. I'm not going to tell you something here that is folly, or something that doesn't have any value, or something that you're not going to get any benefit from. I'm going to speak wisdom. Of course, we know that anything that is wisdom is something we should give heed to. Wisdom is the very opposite of foolishness and misunderstanding and folly. He further says, "And the meditation of my heart shall be of understanding." This is going to be something that comes not only from the mouth, but also from the heart, the mind. He's been thinking about this. He's been pondering this question in his mind. He's been spending some time mentally on this subject. So this is not going to be a shallow teaching that he gives. It's going to be something that comes as a result of deep thinking. He has it in his heart. And it's not going to be something he doesn't believe in. He believes in this because it's something that comes from the heart or from the mind. And of course, the most effective teaching we can give is teaching that we truly believe in ourselves. If we believe it, if we feel it, if we maybe have even experienced it, then we're going to do a much better job of teaching that than if we're just teaching something because it just seems to be a principle and we don't really have any true feeling about it. So this thing is coming from his heart. It's coming from his meditation, and it is of understanding. He further says in verse 4, "I will incline mine ear to a parable. I will open my dark saying upon the harp." He calls this a parable, not because it is figurative and obscure, but because it is a wise saying and very instructive. It is the same word that is used concerning Solomon's Proverbs, and the psalmist will himself incline his ear to it. There is usually found in this word some idea of comparison, and hence usually something that is to be illustrated by a comparison or a story. The reference made here in this psalm would seem to be to some dark or obscure subject which needed to be illustrated, which it was not easy to understand, which had given the writer, as well as others, perplexity and difficulty. So he proposed now to understand it and to explain it, to place his ear, as it were, close to the matter, that he might clearly comprehend it. The matter was difficult, but he felt assured he could explain it. The problem, or the parable, the difficult point, related to the right use or the proper value of wealth. Now he's going to talk about the estimate in which it should be held by those who possessed it and by those who did not possess it. It was very evident that the author of this psalm knew that the views of men were not right on this subject. So he proposed to examine the matter carefully and to state the exact truth. He talks about the fact that he says, "I will open my dark saying." That is, I will explain, I will communicate the results of my careful inquiries. My dark saying really means a riddle or a dark speech or a hard question. It's why that he calls this thing a proverb. It can be properly translated as meaning something entangled or intricate. And then it can mean a parable, a poem, a song, or a proverb. The idea here is that the point was intricate or obscure, that it was not well understood, and so he purposed to lay it open and to make it plain. And he's going to put it upon the harp. And the meaning here means that he's simply going to put it in the form of a song so that it could be sung. It could be placed to music. We find that the great thoughts and ideas of man, the things that he holds as being great truths, usually are somehow or other put into music, put into the words of a song or a psalm. And as these are sung over and over, then they are entrenched into the minds of men. And so it is with the things of God, with the holy things regarding God and the worship of God. He intends for us to sing. He intends for us to sing praises and hymns of admonition and teaching. And so this great truth, then, according to the psalmist, is something that he would put upon the harp. I will open my dark saying upon the harp. I'm going to put it in such a way that it can be sung so that men can know and understand this and pass it on from one to another. Before he gets deeper into his lesson, in verse 5, he applies this to himself. Of course, no lesson is going to have a true effect and meaning upon others unless we are making an application of it in our own lives and can say that we have tested and proven this thing for our own benefit. So he says in verse 5, "Wherefore should I fear in the days of evil, when the iniquity of my heel shall compass me about?" Admittedly, this is a very difficult verse and phrase to interpret. But he's talking about something that's going to prevent him from having fear. And he says, I'll have no need to fear in the days of evil. Now, the days of evil can apply to the time he's living here in this life that have already and will yet in the future come upon him. And there are times of trouble, times of trial, times of distress, days of evil, when the iniquity of my heel shall compass me about. Now, this is where the difficult part comes in. The iniquity of my heels. The phrase, my heels, can refer to his feet, can refer to that upon which he is standing. But it can also refer to the bringing up of the rear, or the rear guard, even someone who would come up behind him. And so it would probably refer to the efforts of those who would try to trip up his heels, those who would try to make him fall. And when they would compass him round about, he would have no reason to fear them, because these are the people who depend upon wealth. These are the people who have an inordinate desire and affection for wealth. They do not have the true values of God, and so he has no reason to fear them. He has his values grounded in those things that are solidly of God. He is looking for God to be his benefactor and his protector, and he's not looking to wealth for this, so he has no reason to fear when these days of evil come, when these times of evil come. And so he is showing that he is living this principle that he's going to teach, that he is an example of one who has been freed from the fears that are brought about by rich persons. And so he's giving an illustration of his point from his own personal feeling and position. This verse could also be interpreted, the iniquity of my heels could be his sins. When his iniquities have compassed him about, whenever he comes to the time of the judgment day, and here these sins are surrounding him, and he sees that God has pardoned his sins, that his conscience is purified, and that even in the judgment day, when the hearts of others fall and fail for fear, he can lift up his head with joy, because he has placed his allegiance in God. He has placed his sense of values upon the things of a spiritual nature, and he has not depended upon these riches to extricate him from his difficulties in that time. So he's simply saying in this fifth verse that he is not going to have to fear the consequences of desiring wealth, or of having an improper sense of values, or of placing his security in the wealth of this life. That he's going to be able to stand whenever the iniquity of his heel shall compass him about. Whether this be his enemies, whether this be his sins, whatever the phrase refers to, he'll not fear in that time, because he has a proper sense of values regarding this subject of wealth. Then he gets into the subject in verse 6 by saying, they that trust in wealth and boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. Now he's introducing those that are improperly using wealth, and he's giving a description of them. They trust in their wealth. They place their security here. Rather than trust in God, rather than depend upon God, they're depending upon their wealth for whatever security they're going to have, for whatever safety they're going to have. They're depending upon, they're trusting in their wealth. And they boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. They're very proud. They're very pleased with their riches. And so they boast about it. They do not make any hesitation to let you know that here's where their security is. And they flaunt themselves in their riches. And they may demonstrate to you how wealthy they are by displaying items that go along with their wealth. In our modern day, this could be by having the biggest and most elaborate car, or the biggest and most elaborate house, or by dressing in such a way, or by spending money in a foolish way just to show that you are able to spend it. They boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. Now he's contrasting them in verse 6 with himself in verse 5. He is in a position where he doesn't have to fear about these things that a man really has to fear, the iniquity of my heels, but they are going to be in a different position. We'd like to note here that this doesn't simply teach that it's wrong to have wealth or riches. It's not wrong to have or to acquire them, but it's our attitude toward them that really counts. And so he's describing the attitude in this sixth verse. They trust in their wealth. They boast themselves in the multitude of their riches. So they have a confidence in their riches. That they depend upon it as their portion and their happiness. And they expect that it'll secure for them freedom from all evil and supply them with all good, and that they need nothing else. No, not even God himself. Their gold is their hope, and so it becomes their God. And thus our Savior explains the difficulty of the salvation of rich people in Mark 10:24. He says how hard it is for those that trust in riches to enter into the kingdom of God. So we must be careful that we not trust in riches. Now, they take pride in their riches. They boast themselves in the multitude of them as if they were sure tokens of God's favor. And as this were a certain proof of their own ingenuity and industry. In other words, they're saying, my might and the power of my hand hath gotten me this wealth, so I must be somebody great. I must be somebody good. I must be somebody that God is favoring because of this. Now, they act as if they had made themselves truly great and happy, and that these riches made them more excellent than their neighbors were. They boast that they have all that they want, and that they can defy all the world, that they are somebody who is the captain of their own destiny simply because of these riches. Then in verse 7, it gets right to the heart of the matter. None of them can by any means redeem his brother nor give to God a ransom for him. These riches will not redeem his brother. That is, will not save his brother from death, will not save his brother's soul from being lost. There's no way that this money can do this. It is not in the power of wealth to do this. They cannot give God a ransom for him. They cannot pay him out of the difficulty that he's in because of his sins. You can't buy a soul from God. You can't give God a ransom for him. There's not enough money, not enough wealth, not enough riches to be able to bribe God into deterring his great justice and judgment upon those who are sinners. And he further says in verse 8, for the redemption of their soul is precious, and it ceaseth forever. Now the word soul here really means life. It doesn't necessarily have to mean the spirit after death, but it can apply to that. But the idea here is that the redemption of their soul is precious. The word precious means valuable. Life is valuable. The saving of life is valuable. And the redemption of our soul, of our spiritual side, is a very valuable thing. It's precious. It's something that we all have a great desire for. It's something that we naturally and normally want to save. But they're going about it the wrong way. They look upon it as being valuable, and they think of their wealth and their riches as putting them above other men in the ability to deal with God and to save themselves. But he says, and it ceaseth forever. This life is going to be taken from this earth. It's going to come to an end. It's going to cease forever, never to be brought back. Their wealth, their riches cannot change this. They cannot buy themselves out of death. They can't even spend everything they have on their brother and keep him from dying. It's going to happen. They can't change it. And so you see how uncertain and how unwise it is to place this kind of emphasis upon wealth and riches, because when the things come along that really matter, the precious thing, the redemption of the soul, the saving of the soul, our life, our ability to live, this wealth has nothing to do with that. It cannot bring about life. It cannot cause us to have our life extended in the eyes of God. It cannot give us salvation. And we close your lesson at that point. Till next time, this is N.C. Crouch saying, goodbye, friends.